the truth of the matter is that South Africa faced the COVID crisis whilst we had just entered into a recession ourselves. So what COVID simply did was that it infected, it put further shocks on the South African economy. And the way in which we had understood the shock was that, firstly, this is a health crisis. And naturally, the first authorities to respond in South Africa were the health authorities. And I think that it was good that it was the health authorities who responded first, because elsewhere in the world, it seemed to have been that it was the central banks that responded first, and I'll come to that. COVID seen initially just a shock on confidence and on risk appetite. But it soon became both a demand and a supply shock. A supply shock because global supply chains got affected, and in most instances, even completely closed. But it also was a demand shock via the demand, the confidence channel, and also through a knock on people's incomes. The natural response for many countries was to go into lockdown and put in social distancing measures. And this actually then exacerbated the problem. And it also led to a situation where people were posing a false dichotomy which said it's either people's health or it's the economy, which was in itself a very false dichotomy. Yes, it was about the health of the people, but the economy is also about people. Economy is there, it serves people, and economy is built by people. And so it is always a challenge for authorities to balance those two objectives. And the lockdowns couldn't last forever. And at some stage, it had to be relaxed. And the approach that was taken in South Africa was a risk-based reopening of the economy. Now, in this environment, it meant that there had to be responses in terms of policies. There had been a response from the health authorities, which was speedy, and we had seen that. Then there was a response from the monetary authorities and the fiscal authorities. Today, I will spend a lot of time talking about the response of the monetary authorities, being the central bank, and how we see that evolving. And what we have seen was that from a central bank perspective, we responded with an adjustment in the policy rate of 275 basis points from January. We had a modest 25 basis point adjustment in January, which was to react to the pending recession. And once COVID-19 hit us, we had to respond much more aggressively. What made it possible for South Africa to respond in this manner? We were able to respond in this manner because the central bank had built buffers and had a history of independence and was able to also use the credibility that we have in the South African policy space, but also globally, that the response of the monetary authorities was always going to be seen to be a prudent response. But we also picked up that there was a dislocation in the financial market. And because there was a dislocation in the financial market, we had to inject liquidity into the market. Firstly, by putting in additional repo facilities for the banking sector to meet their liquidity requirements. And secondly, by embarking on some bond purchases to facilitate the functioning of the market. And to be clear, we were doing this because we wanted the markets to continue to function rather than because we didn't like the price that we had seen in the market. We also provided regulatory relief to the sector by the South African banking sector is always well, has always been well capitalized with ample liquidity, and it had ample buffers. And we allowed them to dip into those buffers so that they could continue to support the economy. The fiscal authorities did respond with some fiscal relief measures, but they didn't have the extent of the space that the monetary authorities have. So that is where we are. But providing relief and that could stimulate demand is not going to work if the economy is in a lockdown. And so the measures that we had taken, the effect thereof will only be felt now as the economy reopens. And we will continue to monitor that, and we stand ready to deploy our tools to provide relief to the South African economy.
Do you have a feeling yet of how this is going to affect the South African economy, or is it just too early to say?
Well, it is too early to say, but we can already tell what the effects are. What we are not able to do is to attach a number to that. We expect the South African economy to contract by 7% this year. Some people say that we are optimistic, but it is a forecast that we could go with given the evidence and the data that we have at the moment. It's like making policy in the dark, because even the statistical agency, SSA, was under lockdown. And the figures that they are going to be releasing are going to have to be adjusted figures rather than the figures they would have normally released. And they had to delay the release of the gross domestic product number. So they would have had to delay the inflation, the publication of the inflation numbers. And from us as the central bank, one of the publications that is used is the South African Reserve Bank quarterly bulletin. The June quarterly bulletin will now only be released in July, because we need to reconcile things with South Africa. But let me just paint this this picture. What you have heard under the lockdown was that people were restricted in terms of the goods and services that they could actually purchase. That meant that the retail sector could only be operating to provide what was deemed to be essentials. Understandably, very few people then were going to shopping centers to observe social distancing. That basically meant that the retailers were going to be struggling with rental, and they approached the landlords and they were asking for relief from the landlords, saying that, well, they cannot pay the renter, and which means that if they are not paying the landlords, if the landlords have bonds, the landlords end up saying to the bank, sorry, but I can't service my bond because the tenants are not paying. So the property sector would be adversely affected. The financial sector too will be affected. The earlier indications that we had seen had been that financial activity was lower. During the lockdown, people were not swiping their credit cards. They were not withdrawing cash from the ATMs and so forth. So you would expect that would happen. If the retailers were struggling, that goes without saying that their suppliers are going to be struggling as well. But there are things. I mean, landlords are going to have to confront something. The kind of things that they have seen of very generous rental increases from year to the, 1 year to the next is going to be a thing of the past. Because as it stands now, with us, you in London, and we are able to converse like this, the question comes, well, why do I have to fly to London to come and meet you if we can do it in this manner? And similar questions are being asked as office-bound workers are able to continue working remotely. And there's going to be question marks about the amount of office space that firms actually require. So the property sector is also not going to be the same. But even as we open the economy, there are some businesses that might actually not make it in spite of the support that we are providing. And one of the support that we had to provide this was that together with the National Treasury and the Banking Association had to provide relief to small to medium-sized enterprises to take them through over the next 6 months and assist them with the cash flow. That means that the banks themselves would have had to make additional provisions, and we have to provide them with regulatory relief so that they are able to support clients in an environment like this. One of the sectors that was kept open on a limited basis was mining. And the reason was a very simple one. Our electricity is coal-fired, sure. And we needed the coal, so we needed to keep the mines open. But our mines are deep, and because our mines are deep, social distancing is very difficult. And so the stage was to first open cast mining and say that if you use those that they are able to maintain social distancing. We already had on one or two of the mines where there was a range of infections of up to 100 people. For example. So it's going to be difficult. I think that the key message here is that there might be a post-COVID economy at some stage. I don't know when that post-COVID economy is going to be. I don't know whether it's a year, 2 years, or 3 years. I don't know. It depends on whether you get a vaccine or a cure. I don't know. What is in no doubt, though, is that over the next 12 to 24 months, we are going to have to learn to live with an economy in the era of COVID. We are going to have to manage an economy in the context that COVID is here and we are going to have to learn to live with it.
What are your thoughts about tourism? I guess probably going to be one of the last to come back. Is that a sector that you're going to, did you see increasing support going to have to be directed towards?
The tourism sector suffered enormously. And I mean, in the region, there are two other countries which are so tourism intensive. Their economies are decimated. I mean, Seychelles and Mauritius, that's what they offer. They offer tourism, and people can't even get there, even if they wanted to get there. And in South Africa, we had also seen that initially it looked like the epicenter of the virus was going to be Johannesburg and Gauteng, but now it looks like it's Cape Town and the Western Cape. The Western Cape is also one province that is very dependent on tourism. When people think I am going to South Africa, they think of Cape Town, they think of Table Mountain and the sea, right? So tourism, we're going to have to restart the sector because it's a very important area of foreign exchange, but also we're probably going to have to restart with domestic tourism. The Minister of Tourism had been having these conversations with the sector, but it's really, really tough. Even as we open the economy now and people are going back to work, people are reluctant to stay in hotels. So people are having to take long drives to go to some of them if they can't do things remotely and so forth. So the tourism is going to suffer in both of its aspects. Business tourism in the form of conventions and all of that. And then, of course, the leisure tourism of people who would like to explore places. But even as you open tourism, Chris, have we cared to look at what is happening in the aviation sector? It's being decimated. No. I mean, unless these aeroplanes are flying, they cannot earn a revenue. And you just see the airlines all in trouble, and that is going to be the challenge. So tourism is going to take time to come forth, and tourism and the aviation sector are so interlinked. So it's also going to be a function of whether the aviation sector is able to be restarted in good time. But even as we start and you say that you are reopening tourism, think of it. I mean, you and I used to spend a lot of time on aeroplane. How do you maintain social distancing in an aeroplane?
The external side of the economy, is that something which is a particular concern right now?
As we reopen the economies, obviously the external side is going to be important. But for emerging market economies like South Africa, most of us are small open economies, if not all of us. And that means that international trade, international finance are important for our economies. And the sooner international trade reopens, the better. But there is a worry that I have. And the worry that I have is that there had been a movement against globalization.
Yeah.
And some of those voices against globalization seems to be emboldened. And so you are likely to see a rise in protectionism, which is what the world does not quite need at the moment. And we used to think of protectionism in terms of you can't have access to my market. So it tended to be you can't have access to my market. But we are also seeing a disturbing kind of protectionism now, where people declare certain goods as strategic or important, and therefore these goods cannot leave our shores. You saw it. I mean, Europe was not particularly exemplary. There were countries that were talking about restricting the export of protective equipment, which basically meant that it becomes difficult to cap these things in emerging economies if the attitude is that, no, we need this for ourselves, ourselves first. And even as people talk about finding a vaccine, it also depends who cracks the vaccine. I mean, there are leaders who have come out and said that, no, sorry, if this vaccine is cracked, it's a global public good. But that does not stop some presidents of some countries that if it is their country that cracks it first, that they will say, my people first. And I worry that in so doing, we might just be losing our humanity.
Do you have any concerns about your debt to GDP ratio and how you see that?
Look, as a matter of course, we do not comment about fiscal policy. But in this environment, what we had faced was that we saw a dysfunction in our financial markets and we started to do bond purchases. And as we were doing the bond purchases, there were louder voices coming up in South Africa that says that you have got to do quantitative easing. There were voices that were saying that, well, government can't afford this interest bill. Why doesn't the central bank just lend to the government at 0% interest? And how have we thought about this? Firstly, was that our bond purchases had nothing to do with trying to affect the shape of the yield curve or to try and push the yield curve lower or anything of that sort. It was to get the financial markets to function as part of the mandate of the central bank, one of which is to oversee the financial system and make sure that there is resilience in the financial system. And that is what we ended up doing. But let me also say that there is a limit to central bank purchases, especially if you are an emerging market. It's okay for the US to embark on massive QE when they are faced with in very extremely low inflation and where their interest rates are close to zero. It's okay for the UK to talk about do quantitative easing when they are faced with that similar situation. It's okay for the European Central Bank to embark on quantitative easing when euro area inflation was at 0.1 or something like that, and that at some stage even threatening to go negative. And it's okay for Japan to do it because they had faced deflation, and so they ended up doing that. All of these countries can do these things with the knowledge that their currencies are reserve currencies. And because their currencies are reserve currencies, people will continue to hold them.
Sure.
And so even as the US was embarking on quantitative easing, what you saw was people running to the US saying they are running to the safe haven of the dollar. That is not a luxury South Africa has. So we can go in and try and get the markets to function, but you can't embark on a massive quantitative easing when you do not have a currency that is a reserve currency. Secondly, is that our inflation has declined, but we still have inflation. We still expect it to average 3.6 this year. And our policy rate is at 3.75. We are almost getting to neutral in terms of real rate. And so unless inflation declines significantly further, the ability to provide further monetary easing is limited. There is still scope for us to continue to support the economy, deploying our tools, but it is not an unlimited space. That is what the point I am trying to make. And lastly, given that we're not a reserve currency, massive QE will eventually find itself into the foreign exchange market. People will find that it is cheaper to create foreign exchange that way if there are just cheap or free rent coming into the market. And what you might then end up seeing would then be a depreciation of the currency, which could then reignite inflation and all of that. At the moment, it is not our worry that we will have a surging inflation over the next 12 to 18 months. Part of it being the prudent stance that the central bank has taken, and the fact that the currency actually recovered over the past month suggests that the steps that we have taken have been seen to be prudent rather than reckless.
Do you have any other thoughts on what the post-COVID world is going to look like?
I wish I could know what it would look like, but lessons we have learned, very valuable lessons. The first lesson for me is that building policy buffers is very important. The countries that were able to respond with fiscal policy and with monetary policy were those which had the policy buffers to do so. And you had raised the question, for example, about South Africa's debt. Getting into the 2008 crisis, South Africa had net debt of 23% of GDP. So there was the policy buffer. It got into this COVID crisis with debt to GDP over 60%. Based on the pressure of its own projections, debt to GDP could easily get to 80%. And if it gets to 80%, questions have got to be asked. Should you be hit by a new crisis with debt to GDP at 80%, would you be able to respond? Sure. And the answer is that, well, you might be able to respond, but that does not look like that is the option that you have. You will not be able to respond with a massive stimulus. I mean, the fiscal stimulus, the stimulus that was provided now to respond to COVID was just about 500 billion rand. Truth of the matter is that in 2008, we were able to respond with close to a trillion rand. And the reason for that was that we had the policy buffers. And those policy buffers, from a central bank perspective, it included us having inflation contained to where we wanted it, which was closer to the midpoint of our inflation target range. So inflation was below 4.5%. So that gave us the scope to be able to, that was one policy buffer. The second policy buffer from a central bank perspective had to do with the regulatory capital and the liquidity that was imposed on the sector and the buffers that were kept by the sector above the regulatory capital and the liquidity buffers that, so we were able to release that. And thirdly, that because we have had such a deep financial market, and that government had always financed itself in the bond market, when there was a dislocation in the bond market, the central bank was able to deploy its balance sheet to get the financial market to work so that government can continue to fund itself. So that the buffers become important. The last one is that even in the private sector, the building of redundancies is going to be important. We're going to have to revisit the just-in-time models, because as it stands now, we are running a just-in-time model and the global supply chains are disrupted in this manner. Your business is under serious risk. So you're going to have to build redundancies. And governments are going to end up having to build redundancies. I mean, how does the whole world suddenly realize that they do not have enough protective equipment? And we have to, so we are going to end up having to build redundancies in so many different areas. And it's going to be the norm. And these things come at a cost. And both the public sector and the private sector would have to build redundancies in order to prepare themselves for a next crisis. And lastly is that in South Africa, we have seen one of the criticisms of the South African corporate sector has been that the South African corporate sector is sitting on huge cash balances. And the way in which we have always said that when they are sitting on cash balances, it might be a reflection of confidence, and that if you restore confidence, this cash would be deployed. One of the lessons now is that the businesses that had thin cash reserves got into trouble very quickly. Put simply, there is no business that can go bankrupt because it is keeping too much cash. And so the narrative that we have had in banking and in financial markets, which said that if you are sitting on cash, you have got a lazy balance sheet, give the cash back to the shareholders and all of that. Now, when you need the shareholders because the business is in trouble, the shareholders is exactly the time when they themselves would not be in a position to place capital into businesses. So buffers, building redundancies in both the public and the private sector, that is, for me, the biggest lessons from this crisis.